Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Let's put aside whether or not Andrew was involved in the wrongdoing. Surely the right thing to do is to share what he knows about what were crime scenes.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
This is the first time such a strong competition between countries about hosting COPs is unprecedented.
Australia has given up its bid to host the COP31 climate summit, making way for it to be held in Turkey. Now, across various ABC platforms today, you'll hear just what Australia is getting out of this compromise. But today we're going to get the Turkish perspective and find out why the Turkish government wants this summit held in Istanbul. Then, back home, an inquiry into Forever Chemicals has delivered its final report. Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe will be here to discuss. And
the same disease happens to one in Australia, in Germany, in UK, in India. But why do same people get different outcomes? And that inequity was embedded in the way that I took medicine.
Neurologist and leader in global health equity, Dr. Sonu Baska. He's just been recognised at the Asian Australian Leadership Awards, and he'll share his story. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the breaking news that came after Radio National Breakfast went off air this morning. The Climate Change Minister, Chris Bowen, conceding that Adelaide isn't going to host the COP31 United Nations Climate Change meeting. Mr. Bowen says Turkey and Australia are finalising a deal which would see him take on the COP presidency, a key role to lead climate negotiations, while allowing Turkey to host the major event. As part of the deal, the Pacific would also host a climate change meeting with global leaders ahead of the main COP gathering. Now, Australia has been canvassing this deal with Pacific leaders over the last couple of days, saying it had to strike an agreement with Turkey to stop COP31 reverting to the German city of Bonn. So why is Turkey so keen to host this summit? Dr. Umit Shahin is head of the climate policy program at the Istanbul Policy Centre. He also teaches a course on climate change and environmental politics. He came on with Sally before news broke of this agreement to explain just why there's been so much competition around this summit and why Turkey wants to host it.
Why do you think it's so difficult for Australia and Turkey to reach agreement on who should host COP31?
I really don't know, because I've been joining these COPs in the last 15 years, actually, and more than 15 years, and this is the first time. So such a strong competition between countries about hosting COPs is unprecedented. But I don't know, maybe it's because the COPs are becoming more prestigious lately, especially after the Paris Agreement. And in the BEOC countries, in the Western Europe and other countries group, only few countries didn't really host COP. Maybe that's why.
Why do you think hosting COP31 has been so important for Turkey and for President Erdogan?
Yeah, there could be several reasons. One is, of course, about climate policy, because Turkey's first bid to COP was in 2019, and it was before Turkey ratified Paris Agreement. But that time, Turkey was really trying to enhance its climate policies. And then in the first COP bid, Turkey withdrawn for the UK for the COP26. Then actually, many things changed. And Turkey ratified Paris Agreement just before COP26 and then declared its net zero target for 2053. And since then, there's a lot of new policy, including the climate law, new ETS system, etc. In this sense, Turkey is trying to become more influential in the climate politics. This could be the one reason. But I think there could be another reason, which is probably more important, and this is about claiming a leadership in the diplomacy, in the global diplomacy. And Turkish government is really keen to follow this. For example, next year, Turkey is hosting NATO summit. Also, Turkey is mediating the crisis in Ukraine and in Syria, etc. So in this kind of a global diplomatic scene, Turkey has a role now and wants to enhance its role. Probably this kind of a soft policy instrument, which COPs are really an important soft policy instrument, Turkey wants to enhance this impact in the global scene.
What's the situation currently with energy generation in Turkey when we're looking at things like renewables or fossil fuel generated electricity? What does it look like in Turkey at the moment?
Yeah, this is, as the civil society and academics and the climate experts in Turkey, this is our main priority, actually. We try to push Turkey for a coal phase-out policy because although fossil fuels are less important than before today, but still more than 50% of the electricity generation and almost 80% of the primary energy generation is coming from fossil fuels. And the share of, in the electricity generation, share of coal is something like 35% in total, but still the renewables are also developing. And now almost 20% of the electricity generation is coming from solar and wind. And together with hydro and others, non-fossil resources are close to 50%. So I think this COP could be an important driver for pushing Turkey for more clean energy policies and most importantly for ambition for coal phase out or coal phase down trajectory and a better emissions reduction target.
How likely do you think it is that there will be a compromise between Turkey and Australia on the hosting of COP?
I really don't know. In Belém here in Brazil, we are really watching this like a football match. It's very unlikely. And I still don't know. This morning, actually, we heard news that Australia is stepping down, but then it was not confirmed. And when I asked to Turkish delegation, they also say that nothing is clear yet. So we will see now the ministers are here. Probably they are negotiating further. So we will see in a couple of days, maximum until Saturday. And I think the chances for Turkey is higher now.
And that interview with Dr. Umit Shaheen, head of the Climate Policy Program at the Istanbul Policy Center, before news from the federal government that Australia would be conceding its bid to host the COP31 UN climate change meeting, a deal being finalised allowing the climate change minister, Chris Bowen, to take on the COP presidency while Turkey would host the major event. So the federal government isn't waiting for the results of a Pentagon review into the AUKUS pact. It's been spruiking Australia's capacity to own, operate and maintain nuclear-powered subs at Navy bases in New South Wales and Western Australia. Yesterday, the Prime Minister announced the first contractor to supply parts for the US Virginia-class submarines. Pat Conroy is the Minister for Defence Industry and also the Minister for Pacific Island Affairs.
I need to ask you the are we there yet question. When are you expecting the results of this review from the Pentagon about AUKUS?
We know it's very imminent and so we expect it shortly, but we don't we're not in a position to announce when that is. That's a decision for the US government. But we take a lot of confidence in what President Trump said in his historic meeting with Prime Minister Albanese, that AUKUS is going ahead, full steam ahead.
Are you expecting that this AUKUS review, are you expecting it by the end of the year? Is that the kind of time frame we're in?
Well, we're not going to get drawn into speculating about the timeframes. We expect it to be imminent, but we're getting on with the job.
So how significant is the announcement of this first contractor to the construction of Virginia-class submarines?
This is very significant. We're running two separate qualification programs where we're qualifying Australian companies to produce parts for not just our submarines, but the US and UK submarines. This is a great way of building our sovereign industrial base to build our own submarines in Adelaide, and it will contribute to the 20,000 jobs that AUKUS will deliver. H.I. Fraser's the first company to qualify to produce three valves and pipe fittings for the US Virginia class submarines. And that means more jobs for Australians, but also helps the US increase the industrial base supporting their submarines.
Minister, the opposition leader Susan Lee will give a national security speech tonight at the Menzies Institute in Melbourne. She's expected to express concern about the nation's fuel supply. Does Australia have enough oil to meet its domestic needs if there were a serious global supply chain disruption?
Well, we're working on increasing our fuel supply, both how much is held in Australia as well as a maritime reserve shipping fleet to make sure that we can transport it around. We've been very clear that what we inherited from the last government was unacceptable. They consistently breached the IEA 90-day standards, and they tried to satisfy it through saying that they had options in fuel on fuel in Texas. We're working to build our fuel reserves in the defence industry. For example, we've provided grants to look at fuel refining in this country. We'll continue to work on that, but Susan Lee's got no credibility on that.
Labor's already had a term to sort out this fuel issue. Why haven't you been able to sort it out?
Well, we are working on it, and we'll continue to do so. We've increased the defence budget by $70 billion, which is the biggest increase in the defence budget in peacetime ever, and we're providing capability at speed to the Australian Defence Force. We're also obviously working on where we can to increase fuel reserves, and that continues to be a work in progress. But I'm not going to say to your listeners that it's solved, but it's a work in progress that we'll continue to work on.
And that is the Minister for Defence Industry and Pacific Island Affairs, Pat Conroy, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe has been chairing a Senate Select Committee on PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, and it's just handed down its final report. It's recommending the government impose a national ban on the use of firefighting foams containing PFAS and to fast-track regulatory reforms to remove PFAS from all food packaging in the country. Now, Labor senators have delivered a dissenting report warning that prescriptive policy interventions may not be supported by the evidence and have, quote, undesirable consequences. Senator Thorpe came on with Sally to discuss the recommendations and just where senators found common ground.
What's the most important thing that there was agreement on?
Well, the fact that we have a problem in this country with PFAS, which is the asbestos of the 21st century. I understand that the government have agreed to going for 3M, the company that invented this toxic chemical that is destroying land and water and creating ill health amongst many communities, not only in this country, but around the world. So it's disappointing to see that the government have put in a dissenting report. I mean, the whole inquiry was supported by all parties. And we have the Coalition and the Greens as members on the committee who've supported these recommendations in full. So it just shows that we need to put more pressure on the government to implement these recommendations that will ultimately save people's lives.
In your view, is there any future for PFAS or any reasonable use of PFAS in Australia in the future?
Look, we understand that PFAS is used in some things like pills, in medications. So, yes, there is some use for PFAS. But people, the public need to know where it is so that they can make an informed decision on whether they consume PFAS or not, and also what the health effects of, say, drinking PFAS in our water has on our bodies and our unborn children. So as long as there are national guidelines on PFAS, then I think people can be better informed. It's better than what we have now, which is not much at all.
PFAS is a very broad group of chemicals, and researchers are still looking at the potential health effects of PFAS exposure. The dissenting report said a causative relationship between the health effects and PFAS exposure has not definitively been established to date. Is a one-size-fits-all approach the right way to go?
I believe so, and we heard from scientists and experts around the world. We know that the US have thousands of claims against 3M and DuPont for inventing this chemical because it does have significant health effects on people's bodies. So this country is so far behind, and they're using that excuse over and over again, and they're putting company profits ahead of public health in this country. So Australia needs to take it more seriously and stop using excuses. We've heard from the experts. We only need to look around the world on how people are addressing PFAS contamination, and we just need to, get up to date with making sure that people in this country don't get sicker from being poisoned from these chemicals.
Lydia Thorpe there, an independent senator for Victoria and chair of the Senate Select Committee on PFAS, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. We're going to end with a really powerful interview today. From humble beginnings in rural India to a global voice in neurology and stroke research, Dr. Sonubhaskar's story is one of great determination. His contributions to medical research and health equity were last night recognised at the Asian Australian Leadership Awards. He took home the overall winner prize. He came on this morning with Sally Sara to discuss just what the recognition means to him.
It's incredibly humbling, and it inspires many of the Asian Australians like us. You know, Australia is a beautiful country, and sense of service is embedded in many of our members of our community. But the racism and discrimination that you have witnessed in the last couple of weeks, specifically in America, and now the spate of attacks within this country, it makes you think that there is divide. The hyphen between Asian and Australian is not a divide, it's a bridge. And that's what this recognition is about. It's a responsibility that we all owe to each other as Australians.
What's your story of journeying to Australia? How did that happen for you, Sonny?
It's been incredibly transformative journey. I come from a very simple, humble family in India, in the eastern part of India. And I still remember I used to walk 5 kilometers to my school. And growing up, I was neurodivergent. And it was things like tying up shoelaces was incredibly challenging. And that caused a lot of bullying and sort of ideation. But I found refuge in books, in secondhand books. And yesterday night, when this event was being organized at the State Library in Victoria, it was a safe space for me because it felt like I'm home in the library. And coming back to the story of library, so we worked incredibly hard and we got scholarships. And that scholarship took me from India to Spain, to Netherlands and Germany. And finally, 14 years ago, I migrated to Australia, and I call Australia as home for the last 14 years. And it's, as I said, it's a great honor to be here. And I think it's a beautiful country.
Sonu, in those childhood days for you, are there people who stand out in your childhood who could see this kid who might struggle to do up his shoes, but you're obviously very, very clever academically in other ways. Who nurtured that talent and curiosity?
I think the biggest inspiration for me in my childhood, from my childhood times, were my grandfather, my late grandfather. And I spoke about in yesterday night that there's a particular instance when I came back and somebody pushed me from behind. My glasses broke. And when I came back and I spoke, and my grandfather saw I was visibly upset, and he brought me close and he said to me that there are a lot of people who want to change you, but remember, you are the architect of your own story and you'll build a new one. And the sort of, the mentoring, the support and compassion that my grandfather taught me was incredibly inspiring for me. And he's not there anymore. He passed away. But I think his lessons and his life has been one of the greatest motivation in my life.
Tell me about where this initial curiosity for neurology research started. It's a very specific field. How did that all begin for you?
There are two important incidents in my life. The first one being that my mother's side grandfather died early, and he died after a septic shock after his surgery. And that brought me very early in my life that there are inequities in healthcare. The same disease happens to one in Australia, in Germany, in UK, in India, and other places in the world. But why do same people get different outcomes? And that inequity was embedded in the way that I took medicine. And one of the areas in the human medicine that really inspired me always was the brain, because it's full of these, you know, millions and billions of neurons that connects and talk, that mediates our thought, our perception of human life. And it fascinates me that even today, despite technology and innovations, we knew very little about human brain, and it continues to baffle us.
How much inequity do you see in things like stroke? Because people's health conditions, things like smoking, their exposure to things during their work, those pieces can come together often in a catastrophic event.
Oh, that's a great question. See, that the inequity is like, there's a very interesting report that indicates that the postcode of the patient determines the outcomes in after stroke. And that's the reason that if you look at the inequity between the urban and the rural divide, patients that suffer stroke in rural populations in Australia, by the time they come to Sydney, by the time they come to Melbourne, it takes a longer time. And stroke is a time-dependent treatment, which means that sooner the patient comes in, better the patient these get. And like in rural populations, many of these patients don't get diagnosed properly. Even after stroke, even when they get acute stroke treatment, they don't get long-term rehabilitation. And that cause has like lasting impact on these populations. This is we're talking about Australia. Mm. Beyond Australia, these inequities are quite rife in many other parts of the world as well.
So now I'm talking to you from our Parliament House studio in Canberra. It seems likely that we're headed for another debate on immigration policy. How what would your advice be to politicians in the way that they speak about issues of immigration?
Well, I think our politicians, I mean, Australia is a diverse country. I still consider that political spectrum in Australia is one which the rest of the Western world can look up to. We have a relatively stable political system in Australia. But I think the language and the way we refer and unbelong our migrant communities sometimes can have repercussions, whether it's a small racist attack in Sydney or in Melbourne, and those attacks target innocent people. And I think that we also, undermine the opportunities and the contributions of migrants in Australia. And I think we have with the migrants in Australia, we need to see that there is an enormous benefit that migrant communities contribute in making a better Australia, a compassionate Australia. And a country such as Australia, which is a country of migrants, we should be celebrating them, not being othering them. And I think this award and this platform is to recognize that no matter whichever part of the world you come from, Australia is your home, and we should celebrate just like as we celebrate our families.
And that was Dr. Sonu Bhaskar, recognized at the Asian Australian Leadership Awards overnight. He's a global voice on neurology and stroke research. Thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview, including that one with Dr. Sonu, was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Scott. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you tomorrow.